Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 41. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films. Matt Scalisi, editor of FilmNerds.com.
Matt. Ben. What's up, man? So, yet another Marvel movie came out, and you and I are fans of the Marvel brand. I think you saw Ant-Man, what, was it Thursday night, maybe?
Oh, I went to the Thursday night show, sir.
Yeah, you had to...
It was like me and eight other people.
Well, I went Saturday, and it was actually a pretty big crowd there, and a big reaction from the crowd, actually.
That's cool.
Yeah,
we
had
very different experiences. I obviously had a really small crowd, but it was an intense crowd. So, like, I had the kind of crowd where there was a dude that laughed out loud at the Tales to Astonish reference.
Yeah.
So,
I thankfully wasn't the only person that laughed at that. I wasn't the only filthy nerd. we had a crowd that was pretty good. It was actually a pretty positive experience. In terms of Film Nerds 2015 summer movie experiences. There wasn't any audible dialogue going on in the theater. Nobody was talking to the screen. And I kind of get right to this point. Michael Peña was kind of the star of the show. He got more reactions from everybody than anything else in the movie. And I think that, I guess this is something that I've had on my mind for a few days, is that I don't know if the internet outrage, culture is getting to me or is influencing me here, but when Michael Peña first came on screen with T.I. and the guy that was the crazy dude in The Dark Knight, I had, like, this weird, like, fear of racism. Like, I felt like, oh, well, here they go making, you know, the comic relief these minority characters that are criminals. And I'm not sure if the movie ever really got past that necessarily, but it really colored how I received the gags from Michael Peña's character. So for the whole movie, I was kind of wrestling with, like, is it okay to think this is as funny as it is?
That never bothered me, I guess,
yeah.
but it's because I like Michael Peña and his
He's
thing.
So great.
Like he has a shtick. And I mean, the only other thing I've seen him in that I can remember is that he has sort of a memorable arc in Eastbound and Down, the HBO series, where, I mean, he was similarly a show stealer in that. I mean, he is like every scene he has in that show is incredible. And the way that he was used in this movie, I don't really even think that the dialogue that he has is that funny. I think it's all his personality and his delivery.
Yep.
And he's so likable. And I think also the fact that they built these two very clever, I know this will come up a few times, so let's go ahead and elephant in the room, get it out there. But to me, the most Edgar Wright influenced parts of the movie were the two scenes where Michael Peña is basically overdubbing some dialogue. And I think those scenes work better than any other comic set piece in the movie. And it's because they're visual, it's visual comedy, which is exactly what Edgar Wright would have brought so much of to this movie, but I think probably still influenced it in a way enough.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking when I watched the movie. I was like, ah, here we go. Here's one of the vestiges of Edgar Wright's work on the movie.
Yeah, and you know, I just think it's also unusual to have a character like that gets such a strong reaction in these Marvel movies. They really haven't done any of that yet. I mean, if you think about all
like,
the secondary characters in these other Marvel movies, he's probably the one that's made the biggest splash.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they've tried, and it just never really lands. You know, the Kat Denning character is very similar, but
yeah,
she's just not as funny. She and And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the lines that he is given are pretty clever and they're fun and everything. But yeah, it's just the way, like, I found myself just replaying his performance in my head. Like, it just makes me crack up the way that he says stuff. And it has, you know, I like going back to my, my fine fear, you know, going back to, you know, the racial part of it, none of that really bugs me because it's just funny. It's just a funny character. And the last thing I remember Michael Peña in was Crash. So I only really know him as a dramatic actor. He was a big surprise for me here. And, kind of one of my big takeaways. But that's not to say that there weren't plenty of other really effective comedy beats in the movie. I think that I think Michael Douglas actually has a few really great line deliveries and reactions. And in general, I think Paul Rudd is he's such a likable guy just in general. That's why he usually gets cast as an unlikable guy, an unlikable hero. Because he can deliver sarcastic stuff and still, you know, be somebody that you want to spend time with.
Right. We know it's like so obvious that it's a parody coming from him when he's being an asshole. But in this movie, you know, you think about the fact, because I actually was trying to give a quick synopsis of this movie to someone over the weekend, and they were saying, you know, I'm saying, so he's like, you know, he's a thief. He's like a master thief, and they need him to wear this suit that gives him the superpower of shrinking. And so the person I was talking to says, like, oh, so he's like a anti-hero, like a villain. I was like, no, he's really not. Like, he's a criminal, but he's a really good guy. Like, he basically doesn't have any character flaws just from what you can see in the movie, other than the fact that he does things that get him put in jail.
That's the only thing
wrong with him.
He makes bad decisions. You know, he's a super nice guy, and he's sincere. You know, there's not the typical Paul Rudd sarcasm, which would fit in the Marvel universe, but is already, you know, so much there in Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Pratt's Star-Lord. So, I mean, having yet another comedic actor playing a sarcastic superhero would have been, I feel like, overkill. So I really like that they were able to bring his natural likability to this guy that's, like you said, even the crimes he commits are kind of noble in a way.
Oh, his main crime, that he got put away for is that, like, he stole money that had already been stolen by an evil corporation, and he gave it back to, like, four people, basically.
Right, so, yeah. And
they set it up from the get-go that this is not, like, you know, they don't give you any reason to not like this guy. And I think Rudd, I honestly was pretty skeptical of that casting when it first came out. And I guess it's just because I didn't remember how likable he can be. And
yeah,
he has a lot of, you know, he has quite a few moments in this movie where I think, like, yeah, Paul Rudd's the only guy that could have done that scene that way. You couldn't have just put somebody else in it. I mean, the one that jumps out at me that I remember off the top of my head the most is near the end of the movie. He has a scene where it's really kind of his first true romantic beat with the Evangeline Lilly character,
yeah,
where the door opens on them, basically. And he has, like, he reacts to that scene is great. It's a really funny, super likable moment for him. And, you know, I just thought, I forgot how different Paul Rudd's version of that likable guy is from everybody else's. But I think it really is, and this movie showed it. So one of the things that I think there was trepidation about going into this movie, particularly for people who maybe aren't as hardcore brand loyalists like you and I are, is how they were going to try to tie this into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because it's presumably pretty separate. You know, I mean, the on its face, this movie doesn't have a lot to do with the Avengers or anything else. So I am curious how you felt about the attempts to connect it. I mean, there are basically three beats in this movie.
Yeah.
where they connect it to the larger universe. I would say that I overall like what they did with it, and it didn't feel intrusive to me. It didn't feel like it took over. I would actually say that it took over the movie a lot less than it has in other standalone Marvel films. But I'm curious how you felt about it.
Yeah, so if we haven't said already spoilers, I don't think we've said anything that would be considered a spoiler yet, but we're about to. First, going back to the Paul Rudd being likable thing, there's a great line in this movie where he's like, well, the first thing we need to do is call the Avengers, which is one of those lines that you kind of wish you heard in other Marvel movies. And not only is it delivered wonderfully and for the right reason, it's not a gag. It's actually like, that's what this guy would say, because he doesn't feel up to the challenge.
That's what you would do in all of these movies. If anything ever happened,
right,
they would just call the Avengers. Yeah.
Right. But Hank Pym has this amazing answer, which is that's set up in the beginning of the movie, that Howard Stark and S.H.I.E.L.D. wanted to use his suit in a way that he didn't like. And now, because of what he saw in the news and everything with Age of Ultron, that he doesn't think he can trust another Stark with that suit. And I think that's brilliant. You know, it's such a great way to A, address that thing, and then B, call out to the other film, but also call out to the next film. You know, I mean, that leads directly into the conflict in Civil War. So that's a wonderful example of the extended universe idea working for this movie, you know? And
it actually solved the story problem, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It creates new ones. You know, it furthers the bigger story of Tony Stark's Iron Man, and then it addresses the story things in this one. So I love that. Whenever he is trying to get that the part, and they say something about it being in like a Stark facility in like upstate New York. Like, something went off in my head that was like, that seems important. It seems important that they said that, but I don't know why. I'm probably just being a weirdo. That probably won't be important. And then they fly over the thing, and it's of course the new Avengers facility from the end of Age of Ultron. And I was super excited about that. And I thought, well, that's just great. That's just this wonderful. It's just this wonderful way to...
I know where this is going, though.
Well, it's this wonderful way to set up geography, you know, in this universe, to say, look, if you go 6 miles that way, eventually you're going to hit this Avengers thing, and that's it. You know, it's just this building that's here. However, I do think they took it a little bit too far when he lands at the facility, and there's nobody really, you know, there's not a whole lot going on there, and then the Falcon flies in, and I guess it's supposed to be that, like, there's nobody really there, and then all of a sudden the Falcon shows up and he's talking to, you know, somebody inside, or, you know, communications person inside or somewhere else. And it spends so much time on this really neat fight scene with the Falcon that while I liked it all, I didn't have a really problem with how it was pulled off. It was just that it was there and that it was just him. And I think it really hurt the Falcon. I feel like it hurt that character and made him come across as just this C-level, like, I feel sorry for Anthony Mackie for being just like the C-level guy, the jobber that they sent out there. I mean, if they had just shot an insert of Scarlett Johansson at the comm, you know, or if they show just anybody inside the building, or
I mean, what,
Smulders,
what's Colby
or somebody
Smulders
like that.
Doing? Yeah,
yeah. Just show who he's talking to. Let us know that there's somebody else in this empty field other than this one like superhero. That, and it may not have been such a bad thing if he hadn't just shown up and done this exact same thing in Age of Ultron. It just seems like a really cheap kind of thing where it's like, well, we need a cameo. Who we got? Nobody? Oh, we got the Falcon? Okay, we'll throw the Falcon.
They're all busy.
Yeah. Now, let's look at the contracts. Like, how many more times can we use Anthony Mackie before, oh, man, we only have four more times? Well, I guess we just won't use him in the second part of Infinity War. You know, it's just, I don't know. It felt really cheap and I don't know, harmful. Like I said, like, after that scene, I was like, he's just kind of a loser now. He's like,
I understand your sentiments there. I will say, so first of all, I do agree that I think production-wise, it's not complete. You know, I think they should have rounded it out a little bit more, and it definitely feels like a thing that was tacked on. Aside from that part of it, though, so look, let's just assume, you know, all the rest of that stuff aside, the fact that they had a scene where the Falcon gets it handed to him by Ant-Man, who is a brand new, you know, hero here.
Right.
I mean, I do think that it's, here's the more I thought about it, here's the conclusion I came to on that. I think that it could end up working good for long term for the whole Avengers thing and for Falcon, because ultimately that guy's got to have a thing, okay? And it's not going to be that he's the most badass one on the team right now, because, you know, we have War Machine on there, and he's not going to be the smart sort of leader, because we have Captain America. I think if you're going to have the Falcon have a character trait, it probably needs to be that he's somewhat insecure and that he is trying to, you know, live up to the rest of the team, and he doesn't want to disappoint Cap, which they give him a little bit of that moment there.
Right.
I'm not saying they perfectly pulled it off, but, you know, I could see it paying off down the road that Falcon is the guy that they probably don't have as much faith in. And yeah, I mean, I think he is sort of C-list Avenger, but that's where they are. I mean, it's story-wise, I think the next time we see all of them, the team's not going to really be as good as it was before. And I think that's part of what Ant-Man is showing you, and what they're going to play with a little bit in Civil War is, like, this ain't the same team that was kicking all the ass in the first two Avengers movies.
Yeah, it's like the 2012 Avengers.
That's right. So maybe that's important to the story. Maybe that will play into it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a point there, because, I mean, Captain America the Winter Soldier starts basically with the Falcon's insecurity as a soldier and athlete versus Captain America's. So, yeah, I can see that that's a consistent character thing. I think mostly, I just feel like if we had just gotten a bit more of an idea of the life going on outside of the facility, or if we'd gotten another Avenger, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, some extras would have helped. Yeah.
The Vision is a totally CGI character. Like, why not just, like, have a, you know, you don't have to pay
Paul
Bettany.
You think you can get away with not using Paul Bettany's contract?
Just have, like, the Vision getting coffee inside the building and, like, look out the window and see the shit going on. And he thinks the Falcon is fighting himself or something. You know, like, you could do it with a gag, but just let us know that there's something else going on other than just this giant empty building, and then the Falcon is just bored, I guess, and just shows up and starts talking to himself. It just felt, I don't know, it felt weird and detached from the greater universe that they're trying to sell us on.
So
I do think, that said, I do think that it set up nicely that last little sequence in the movie where they're looking for Ant-Man. But go ahead.
The other thing that is not as obvious, but that there have been a lot of suggestions out there by Kevin Feige and other Marvel people, that it is potentially connected in some way to some future Marvel films, is the scene where Ant-Man goes subatomic, as they say in the movie, and there's this weird sort of psychedelic kaleidoscope thing going on. It's a really weird thing to put in the movie.
Love it.
And, you know, it's sort of interestingly challenging to the audience from what they've seen up to that point. But, you know, I think, you know, you and I have been having this discussion a lot, and a lot of people are, about how the fact that Marvel doesn't really foster. They have this reputation that they don't work well with you know, let's say filmmakers with an independent spirit to them.
Yeah, auteur directors.
Yeah, you know. And that said, if you look at their last three movies now, and I'll say Guardians of the Galaxy and Age of Ultron and Ant-Man, I think they all have moments in them that don't at all feel like run-of-the-mill, factory-made blockbusters. There are moments in all three of those movies that I would call exceptional filmmaking moments.
I would go ahead and extend that to Winter Soldier. I mean, that's...
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The action sequences in that movie are totally, totally different than what you would see in Terminator, Genesis, or other movies that I haven't actually seen.
So, even though I think maybe we don't know the names involved and consider all of those directors, with maybe the exception of Joss Whedon, I don't know, to be like these sort of like A-list auteurs, I think that these movies have all still brought a very high level of filmmaking that is surprising at times and feels like it wants to accomplish something more than launching a toy line or just sort of getting the product back out there. I mean, I think that the subatomic scene is a big part of that, but also everything about the subplot that is a part of, the fact that, you know, there's this past where the Wasp basically, you know, sacrificed herself to save what we thought was the superhero in the movie.
Right.
And, you know, that in and of itself is pretty cool. Just if you're as a newly minted comic book nerd, it's pretty cool that they took one of the most degraded female characters from the comics and they made her the hero that sort of saved the male figure that she's always trailing behind in the comics. But on top of that they sort of opened up, you know, if they end up doing a sequel, and I hope they do, they've sort of left this cool little mystery that's still unsolved out there. It's not something that leaves that makes me feel like this movie didn't resolve itself. But I think that's a cool little thread to leave hanging out there for any potential future installments.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they set it up nicely, in the movie, and then they delivered nicely on a really, really neat moment in the final act. But yeah, I think that it could go such a different direction that it doesn't feel it feels addressed, but not, you know, it doesn't feel like a loose thread. And yeah, I totally agree. I think that with this is a great example of a movie that it has uniquely original and cinematic ideas that serve kind of a more homogeneous purpose. You know, like that seems to be the balance that all comic books strike, especially Marvel comics, especially from the 60s. You know, they had a house style. It wasn't a creator-driven enterprise. It was a story and character-driven enterprise. And that's what they're trying to do with these movies. And, you know, I think that, whatever, you can interpret that in a cynical way, that they're just trying to sell the future movies. But, no, I do think that there is... that auteurs and creative filmmakers definitely have room to play in Marvel, and I think that it's ridiculous to suggest that they don't. I think that they just have to be able to, every now and then, accept a little bit of studio demands, which, with all these movies, these last four movies that we've talked about, there's something in each of those that was pretty clearly a studio directive, you know, whether it's Thanos and Guardians of the Galaxy, or the Thor, the Dark World stuff in Age of Ultron, or maybe the Falcon scene in Ant-Man. I think that filmmakers can do excellent work at Marvel. They just have to be able to accept that you know, their movie isn't going to be 100% controlled by them. And I think that that is, boy, yeah, when I say that out loud, it sure does sound like a big evil thing, but I think that that's,
you know,
different. That's a different thing for movies. I think it's a, it's more of a comics mentality. It's not what that used to mean, which
and,
is.
And at the same time, Ben, you know, here's the thing. I know I'm coming to this as like the guy who, I'm never trying to suggest that doing something the way the source material did it is inherently good or better, but to use comics as an example here, there's been a lot of great storytelling that has happened in comics, okay? I mean, enough that we've now make a lot of movies out of them and seem to like them a lot. And that storytelling, as you're saying here, it's attracted a lot of great writers. A lot of people, by the way, who have gone on to work in movies or have worked in movies first and then gone to write comics.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of them see that experience of working in a in an environment like that as somehow stifling their creativity. That, you know, basically what you're doing is you're jumping into a pre-existing mythology and you're using those pieces to write original stories, but using characters that people already understand and can identify with, you have a jump start on everybody. And, you know, this isn't a situation where like someone's come up with this original idea and then a studio comes in and says, well, let's change some of the things about your original idea. This is somebody who's wanting to go voluntarily jump into this, you know, sort of mythology, if you will, that already exists. And I think that for there to be a force on top of it all that says, look, you know, we have a grand plan and we need you to fit into it. But if you can do that, you know, tell a great story within that structure. And I think there's nothing that's unprecedented about that or all that unusual about it. And I think that, you know, if the filmmakers who are involved in this enterprise, you know, if they look at that comics model and say, look, you know, Kevin Smith and, you know, Joss Whedon before he did the movies, and, you know, a lot of these great, I mean, Frank Miller, who's worked in movies now too, I guess. But these people are hailed for what they were able to achieve in terms of their storytelling with those things, and they all had to fit into somebody else's plan with what they were doing, but they still accomplished great individual pieces of storytelling. And I think that's what they have set up here. You know, it is different for movies, but I don't think that it just doesn't seem inherently bad to me. I just think that what it's doing overall as a whole is going to create other great opportunities for people to tell great stories down the line. You know, because of all of these movies that have come out, I think it's going to create opportunities for somebody else to make another great movie 10 and 20 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, at its
best. The MCU will be going 20 years from now. No reboots.
Yeah. Good Lord. I mean, at its best, what the Marvel brand and what this whole thing affords is for them to make a movie like Ant-Man, you know, with a character that's not as, well known by the public, is that they can slap that Marvel banner on top and still make whatever 70 million or whatever like that, whatever 60 million that it made this weekend.
Yeah, like with, 65.
Yeah, with a character that nobody really has ever heard of and nobody really likes. And now they do, you know, and I think that's Marvel at its best. And in that movie, it's not necessarily, you know, reinventing screenplay structure, but it is giving us totally original ideas about, you know, like the whole subatomic universe idea. That's something that's so cool and hasn't really been touched on in movies before. The whole just shrinking, it's been so long since we've seen a a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Amazing Shrinking Woman, Inner Space kind of adventure movie, and this one does it just as well as those do. And I think that's unique, and it's original, and it's fresh. And they wouldn't have been able to do that if they hadn't had that Marvel banner to assure them the brand, identification. And I think the whole Edgar Wright situation, I think that's an anomaly for Marvel, because that was an example of a filmmaker who wanted to do something idiosyncratic with a unknown character and brought it to Marvel, who had not yet set up their own plan, you know, not as distinctly as it is now. I think that was put together while Iron Man was being put together, if not before. So that was an example of a filmmaker having an idiosyncratic vision, and then that ending up being a conflict with what the studio is trying to do. That wasn't he didn't show up to Marvel, you know, wanting to take over Iron Man, and then they beat him away. You know, he wanted to do something that just ended up not lining up with what they wanted to do. So I don't think that kind of thing isn't going to happen again. Like you said, now they're going to get filmmakers that know what they're getting into that volunteer for it. And whenever
we saw that with Ava DuVernay, who basically, like she said, like I talked to him about it, and they have a way they want to do it, and I don't really want to do that way, so it's fine.
It's not a judgment.
That kind of got
blown
up, that got blown up into a thing. Like she suddenly, I feel like there was this sort of desire to play that out, like Marvel drove her away from the project with their controlling ways. But I think it's just like, I mean, he never hired her, you know. So I mean, I think they're gonna find people who. And I would actually, I'll go out on a limb and make a prediction and say you will actually see more high-profile names directing Marvel movies in the future than maybe you have for this current round. Because I think what's going to happen is I think eventually people are going to start to see exactly how it works. I think people just don't want to be surprised by how that process works. But I think go into it knowing how it is going to be, and what the expectations are, I think you're going to have great creative people who are going to sign up for that and say, that's fine. If these are the rules, and I know these are the rules going into it, and I can do great things within those rules.
And also it's going to afford people that aren't, you know, currently well-known creative directors, it's going to afford them to do things they haven't been able to do before. Look at Peyton Reed. I mean, Peyton Reed has made pretty much just comedies, and now he's made a really solid, fun science fiction adventure movie with some really fun action scenes. Look at what, Joss Whedon had zero chance of being a blockbuster movie director until Marvel rolled the dice on him. And James Gunn, you know, I mean, so I think that it goes both ways. I don't think they're going to get Paul Thomas Anderson to make a Marvel movie, but I think that both sides are okay with that, and that's not a bad thing. So I think that as long as they don't go completely, whatever weak old saltine cracker director, you know, that has an
who's
open
guy,
schedule for 3 months.
Who's the guy that directed Empire Strikes Back, supposedly?
I think you want to say Return of the Jedi. You're saying
that's what Richard
Marquand. Yeah, as long as they're not out shopping for Marquand, they're good. Because Irvin Kershner is a good director. As long as they're not just out there looking for whoever's in the area and has an open schedule for a few months, and that's not what they're doing. You know, I think that.
I could foresee them doing something like what we're seeing on the Star Wars franchise right now, where they are getting people who are pretty respected up and coming names.
I don't think they're going to go as auteurist as a Ryan Johnson. I honestly don't. I do think that they're going to go a little bit more with at least not a person that's as established as an auteur as Ryan Johnson. Like I said, I think that James Gunn, I think, is probably the best example of the kind of you know, the best case scenario is taking somebody that hasn't, that isn't going to get this kind of budget to do something interesting and let him do something interesting. The best case scenario is, you know, there's the Alan Taylor scenario, which is get a TV director and get something that is, in my opinion, just pretty uninspired and just kind of there, or get a TV director and get something completely unique and cinematic with the Winter Soldier. So even in that situation, which is kind of probably the auteur's worst nightmare, is just whatever TV director is out there. Even that can turn out well if you're a fan of Winter Soldier. So, yeah, I mean, I just think in general, I guess it's just kind of come down to a personality thing. I think that it's probably healthier for people to look at what they can do with Marvel rather than what they can't do with Marvel. Because that can't do with Marvel list is probably going to be as long, if not longer, on any other studio movie of this budget.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true. I mean, it's probably less like any other job you could get directing a studio film in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think that there's probably more enthusiasm and more creativity at Marvel than, say, you know, whatever the experience that Alan Taylor had on Terminator, or, you know, Favreau had on Cowboys and Aliens.
Or whoever is, you know, going to be directing, you know, the Martian Manhunter movie or whatever.
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, that's what DC is kind of, that's what their president or somebody just said recently, is that, you know, that they're interested in, you know, letting filmmakers make films, which is confusing to me because that goes directly against what they're also saying, which is we want to make an extended universe
look.
And right now, I mean, it does seem like, hey, look, they let Zack Snyder do whatever he wanted with Man of Steel, kind of, and they're letting David Ayer, looks like he's got a lot of control over Suicide Squad.
And,
so.
And they hired Justin Lin to do Aquaman, right?
Is that right? No,
was that just
Wan.
A root?
James Wan.
Oh, fine.
Wow. Yeah. So
still a good director.
The problem though is that Zack Snyder, you know, isn't. I appreciate if DC is going into the business of auteur driven superhero movies, that's great. That's cool, because that's exactly what Marvel isn't doing. You know, Marvel is leaning on their house style. But hey, why don't you go find some good movie makers if you're going to do that? You know, they did it right with Christopher Nolan. And I guess it's just hard to find people like Christopher Nolan, because Christopher Nolan isn't going to go make a Marvel movie. The only way you're going to get him to make a superhero movie is if you let him do what he wants. And so if DC was in the business of going, you know, counter to Marvel and going up to the Coen brothers or Tarantino and saying, look, superhero movies are going to afford you a market share and a budget that you can't get anywhere else. If you ever want to make a superhero movie, you come to DC and we'll give you the character that you want and you go make that movie. And, you know, that's going to be something special to go against Marvel.
Well,
I would be very happy.
Yeah, I would become a DC fan immediately if I found out that the Coen brothers were making a Golden Age superhero movie.
Jesus Christ. I mean, that would just be, oh, man. Like, like a Captain Marvel Shazam movie directed by the Coen brothers.
Yeah, right.
Everybody wants to see that, but that's not
Absolutely.
What they're going to do, because they still want control over their properties. But unfortunately, they haven't figured out that, like Marvel, if you want that, you got to take it, and you got to be responsible with it, and with that control, make some good movies. But you know, this wasn't supposed to be a DC a DC podcast.
Well, it was always going to come up.
Yeah, it was. But yeah, I mean, so wrapping up, we barely talked about the movie very much. But overall, I think I really liked Ant-Man a lot. It's I one thing I really loved about it was, it's something a lot of people have talked about, was the scale and the stakes. The tone of it. It's such an effervescent movie. The tone of it is so nicely wrapped up in Michael Peña's performance, that I think he's such a good avatar for this movie, because there's an optimism, there's a fun, there's a desire for kind of interrelational peace. You know, there's that too, with between Evangeline Lilly and Michael Douglas's characters.
Yeah.
And even Paul Rudd and Bobby Cannavale, like, they could have made that cop stepdad character such a jerk, but he's just a nice guy. You know, he just wants the best for his stepdaughter.
Yeah, what's interesting is all the characters seem to, like, they want to be around each other. Even the Corey Stoll character, right? That's, like, part of his character is.
Yeah.
He wants to have better relationships with all the people in the movie. He just doesn't happen to because of some choices he's made. But everybody wants to – that comes through in the cast. It seems – it's, and I think that's probably what Peyton Reed brings to the movie as a comedy director is. He had a bunch of people that seemed like they wanted to be there and were giving an effort. And, I mean, not that Michael Douglas is a guy that we think of this way, like the sort of Harrison Ford, Robert De Niro type, where they just, like, they've called it a career and they just show up to get some paychecks. Because Michael Douglas very recently did one of the best performances of his career in Behind the Candelabra. But he's really good in this movie and likable and making an effort. Like, Michael Douglas could say, like, what is this bullshit that I'm doing a superhero movie? You know, like, I guess I need to pay for my vacation home or something. But no, like, he really seemed into it, and he seemed like he was into the character and wanted to be in this movie. And, you know, that kind of little extra effort pays off in a movie like this. Everybody seemed like they liked each other or wanted to like each other and wanted to be in this movie. And, you know, I guess that probably has, I'll credit Peyton Reed with that.
Absolutely.
And the other thing, speaking of Michael Douglas, by the way, we can maybe wrap up on this point. The CGI cosmetic surgery at the opening of the movie, that's the best I've ever seen of that. I don't know that I've ever seen them CGI somebody younger. I mean, we've seen them attempt that in movies before. I've never seen it where I really wasn't sure if it was CGI or not.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it in a 2D showing, and the projector was a little dim. I actually went and complained about it to the manager before the movie. So it was a little dim, and the guy I worked with said he saw an IMAX 3D, and he said it was a little dodgier in that than it was, and he saw it again in 2D, and it was a little dodgier in the IMAX 3D, so I'm kind of waiting to have my final opinion on that until I see it on, like, Blu-ray, or if they, you know, release it online where you can watch it on, like, 1080p on a computer screen. But yeah, I mean, just right out of, like, in that scene, I was like, whoa, is this a clip from Wall Street that they, like,
I know,
you
that's
know,
what it looked
dubbed,
like, yeah.
Did they dub smash Michael Douglas from Wall Street? that's basically what it looked like. It was fantastic.
As good as that effect was, they are 0-for-2 on making Peggy Carter, making old Peggy Carter look like she's actually an old person.
Man, I am actually a fan of Winter Soldier, old Peggy.
Ooh.
I think the first time I saw it, I bought an old woman. I don't know.
They recast Howard Stark. Why not recast Peggy?
I mean, I guess I can't argue with that, but it just kind of works for me. I don't know.
Well, anyway, I think that's probably all I've got to say on the movie, but I liked it a lot. I am looking forward to seeing it again. And
did it crack your top five? Your top five Marvel movies? Did it crack it?
No, I would say it's not top five, but I do like it a lot. If anything, and I don't mean this as a negative to Ant-Man, but it did make me appreciate even more I think every one of these that I see now, I realize more how much better Guardians of the Galaxy is than anything else they've done. It gets better when it has more to be compared to somehow. But yeah. I do like Ant-Man a ton, and I'm legitimately excited that this character is going to be in other movies that I'm going to see. I am excited to see him in Civil War. I'm excited to see him in Avengers movies. I think it's going to be fun, and I think he'll be a good addition to that dynamic that they have.
I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work. I'm a little bit of the mentality that, boy, it's a lot of stuff going on in Civil War. And I really like Captain America a lot, and every new bit of information about more people in Civil War is less Captain America on screen. I'm a little bit hesitant about that, I think there's so much going on in these upcoming Marvel movies that I'm enjoying seeing them and then, you know, looking back at the other movies maybe, but not really looking forward much. So, I mean, if the Marvel Cinematic Universe ended with Ant-Man, I think I'd still be pretty satisfied. I think that I'd like to see them try this a little bit more often. Hopefully Doctor Strange and Black Panther will be more in this mold than they will, you know, whatever, Captain America 2 or Iron Man 3, you know, those movies that
right.
They need to forward. I like Captain America 2, but they need to forward kind of the overall Avengers story. I hope that they're a little bit more idiosyncratic, a little bit smaller, and a little bit more character-based, because I think that really worked out for this movie. And really, I mean, it was a nice, it's a nice place this summer, too, I think. It's probably one of the more kind of bubbly, fun movies that I've seen this summer. I think Age of Ultron got a little bit heavy, and obviously Mad Max is not necessarily a popcorn movie for kids or anything like that. And even Tomorrowland kind of, you know, approached the material with kind of a strange anger. I kind of like the warmth and the lightness of Ant-Man. So I hope that they keep trying that.
Yeah, it's nice that someone's making, you know, fun movies about superheroes. It's a great idea, really. It's a great premise.
Oh man, yeah. I mean, it's.
Let's just go out on that troll. Let's do it. Hit the button.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.